Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lennonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. We'll ask this question later on today. Is the presidential race the low mark in your lifetime for such things as campaigns, for American journalism, and for candidates? But first, we'll check in with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. He'll join us in studio. Actually, he's right here, right across from me right now, to talk about his bid to become Vermont's next governor. And then after we check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News, Jess Alloh, a Burlington Free Press reporter, will join us to talk about her story on background checks for pre-K workers. Her story exposed what seems to be a mess in getting those checks done. But first, it's my honor to welcome to our WDEV studios Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, a Republican candidate for governor. Good morning, Phil.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
CAX recently did a poll where it listed the economy / jobs as the number one issue. Healthcare is number two. Taxes is number three. You could argue that all of those are pocketbook issues. How can you ensure, if you're governor, how can you ensure Vermonters that you will address these economic concerns?
Well, it's been a concern of mine over the last 5 years anyhow, when I became lieutenant governor. I have recognized the need. I did my Vermont Everyday Jobs Tour and went across the state and performed 35 jobs in the shoes of others. And that's what I came back with. A common theme was people are struggling. They're working two and three jobs just trying to make ends meet, and they're trying to pay their property taxes, make their mortgage payments, pay their rent, and they're just not getting by. And that's the problem. I mean, it's this crisis of affordability that we face in Vermont. The cost of living is increasing, and the opportunities are lessening. And I think that that's what people want. They want somebody to focus on that. And again, I took it upon myself to do that over the last 5 or 6 years. I've been consistent in advocating for that and really focusing on that issue, the economy. It's something that we should all agree to, that if we put our heads together and get on the same page, pull in the same direction, that we can accomplish something.
What can a governor do for the Vermont economy, given that a lot of the economy is driven nationally?
Well, I think some of it is the outlook and the messaging. Marketing, I think, is really, really important. We have a great story to tell here in Vermont. We have a lot to offer, and I believe that it's about it. But you go outside the state, and our reputation is we're an anti-business state. And so we need to change the dynamic. We need to change that that role and that thought. And again, I think if we all agree that we can do something about this, and we can't do it by ignoring the fact that we're adding to the problem. The legislature has been adding taxes and fees for the last 6 or 7 years, and that just adds to the issue. This cost of living keeps increasing, and the pressures continue to be borne by the citizens as well as the businesses. So what we need to do is tighten our belts, live within our means, and then get out there and really prove that we have something to offer. We last biennium, 2 years ago, during that two-year cycle, there were over 1,200 bills that were introduced in the legislature, and we went through each and every one to take a look and see how many of those would have had a positive effect on the economy. We found 30 that would have, and in the end, only 3 or 4 passed. So that doesn't tell me we prioritize what's really important to us. And in this last session, just ended in May, I can't for the life of me find one single bill that had any meat to it, any jobs attached to it, anything that would help us out of the situation we find ourselves in. So, again, a focus, a leadership, trying to bring people together, consensus building, because a thriving, more prosperous economy will lift all boats. Everyone will benefit as a result.
As you look through, as you Google and do some searches about Vermont to look at its economy, you find that for retirees, it's not a place that's recommended to retire because of the cost of living here. If you look at a business-friendly environment, it doesn't seem to be business-friendly. If you look at total state and local taxes, it seems to be ranked high in terms of the burden of taxes. How can you change that?
Well, again, I think a more thriving economy will accomplish that, because if you can grow more revenue, if you can have more economic activity, you'll have more resources coming in. There'll be more revenue coming in naturally, rather than raising it by taxation. They'll just be by economic activity. So organically, it will grow, and the coffers will be filled up if we can just again get more activity, more businesses in Vermont to open their doors, expand, new opportunities. We have, you know, on my website, I have come up with a 12-point plan on philscott.org, if anyone wants to take a look. And there are 50 specific ideas on what we can do to help ourselves out. And that's not the end. I just look at so many opportunities. I did this Vermont economy pitch a couple years ago, where I said, I did it in conjunction with others, and we went through the whole year, and we had 7 of these sessions where we asked people to come out and tell us in 5 minutes, advocate their cause, and tell us what we can do as legislators, what we can do as a state government to help them prosper and do things better. And we did, again, 7 of these throughout Vermont. And it was a 5-minute, proactive, tell us in 5 minutes what you can do. And again, there was a tremendous amount of ideas during that time in those 7, all through geographically located throughout the state. And they're still good. They're still good ideas. And all we have to do is a little action, put them into place. But again, there hasn't been that leadership in terms of putting that on the front burner.
It seems that a woman's right to choose has dominated the news in the last few weeks, and certainly dominated the discussion in this election. Although you're a pro-life, the hit is that
I'm pro-choice.
Pro-choice. Yeah. I'm sorry. That's a big mistake.
Yeah. Pro-choice. Phil Scott is a pro-choice gubernatorial candidate.
Let me. Although you are pro-choice, I got it written here and I missed it. Although you're pro-choice, the hit on you is that you've been for parental notification, against late-term abortions. By the way, the same sort of positions that Senator Leahy has advocated. First, can you explain what your position, I think you just did, but explain what your position is, and what do you think of these ads that have been running against you?
Yeah, I believe in a woman's right to choose. I believe that it's something that I've always, as a political figure over the last 16 years, I've always advocated for that. I think what a woman does with her body is her decision to make between her and her family and her doctor, not something the government needs to get involved in. There was a time in 2003, I think 13 years ago, where I was a co-sponsor, signed on to a bill so that we could have it. Sounded at that point in time, it sounded like something we should be talking about, parental notification. My daughters were in high school at that point, in their teens, and I thought, geez, I would want to be part of the discussion. As I'm protective as a parent, I want to be part of the discussion. If they found themselves in a position where they needed some help in that regard, that I would be there to assist them, not to tell them what to do, but to be there with them to help them through this. And again, I just remember distinctly, because around that time I received a call from the high school asking my permission to give one of my daughters an Advil, and I thought, that made sense. I guess if they're going to that extreme, that maybe I should be involved in something as life changing as that. So, but since then I've gone and I've done some outreach. Remember when they were talking about defunding Planned Parenthood? I actually came to defend Planned Parenthood. I went and toured their facility. They do great work with counseling service. They're really essential for women's health in Vermont. And I said, that's really a dumb idea. Defunding Planned Parenthood is a dumb idea. That we should be doing more to advocate for them, because they're part of the healthcare fabric in Vermont, especially for women's health. So I've defended them right along. I will continue to defend them after this is over, because I think they provide an essential service.
What do you think about their ads?
I think it's unfortunate that they would be used in this way. I mean, it was the Democratic Governors Association that gave them $350,000. I mean, they have a role in this. They want to make sure that I don't get elected. I'm not their candidate, obviously. So they gave them $350,000 to run these ads against me. And I think it's unfortunate because if you look at some of the candidates, the Democratic candidates out there, whether it's Senator Leahy or even the vice presidential candidate, Tim Kaine, a Democrat, he's pro-life. And I don't see anybody running ads against him. And I don't see anybody running ads against Senator Leahy. And I would say, I'm more liberal on this issue than Tim Kaine is. And I just think it's unfortunate for them to get involved. Because, you know, in the future, regardless of party, I believe that Planned Parenthood is essential in Vermont. And I think that what this does is when somebody says, you know, you're just another Republican, that puts a line in the sand. And I think what we need to do is find common goals, bring people together, consensus build, so that we can continue to do the good work that's needed.
Does this surprise you in this regard? If you look at the WCAX poll, you're not typical for a Republican. You don't have a gender gap. In when you look at the women's vote, you're very close to Sue Minter in terms of the women's vote, 45-40. That is unheard of for a Republican. Do you think a lot of this has to do with politics to divide, sort of to create an incident where it divides the women's vote?
Well, obviously, they do their work. They're strategic. They watch the polls and they do things based on polling. And I've always said that while polling might be important, I think you have to do what's right and just talk about what you're going to do rather than what your opponent can't. And I've always felt that way, and something I'll continue to advocate for, because if we really want to bring people together in this country, there's such a divide out there. It's so polarizing on a national level, and I certainly don't want to see that here in Vermont. But we're pulling the left and the right is pulling so far apart that there's little left in the middle. And I think it's the moderate centrists that are actually going to get the good work done. And I'm one of them.
I've read some of the op-eds. I've read some of the letters to the editor. Some claim you are a climate denier. Are you?
No. No, I've said climate change is real. I believe that we've caused it. But what I've said publicly is that I understand, and I understand that not everybody shares my view in that regard. So I'd rather find ways that we can agree on something. And I think those same people that may deny it may advocate for energy independence. And if we can both agree that what we want to do is become energy independent, reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, which I think is essential to become energy independent, that's a common goal. So I think that we can get there. I know it's going to take a lot of work to get to 90% renewables by 2050, but I think it's attainable. And I think with new technology, I think it certainly could be helpful. So I'm on board. I'm not a denier at all.
This has been an expensive campaign, and in the primary and the general election, in some cases quite nasty, which you have been on the receiving end in both the primary and the general election. What have you learned in this election? What don't you like about the process? What do you like?
Well, I'm one of those type of people that likes to get something done. I believe in process. I do believe in that the government has a role in some way to try and bring people together. But I'm a consensus builder. I don't believe in the negative aspect. I don't believe you should have to tear your opponent down in order to make yourself look better. I think you should talk about what you can do, what you bring to the table, and advocate for that. I've been talking about the economy since day one. I think that's the issue. That's the issue that we should be fundamentally talking about, what we can do to take care of Vermont and what we can do to have a brighter future, a more prosperous future, which I think is really attainable. It's right in our hands. We just have to act upon it and not get distracted. So it's been great getting around the state. I thought I knew the state fairly well after living here my entire life. running as a lieutenant governor for three terms. But I'm still getting to areas and getting to know people that I've never met, never seen, never heard of. And it's been great. I have to say that it's been a long year, but I can't believe it's only 6 days away from being over. Because at this point, I'm thinking we still have places to go. We have still people to see. So we're beating the pavement over this last week, that's for sure.
What don't you like about the process?
The negativity. You know, I don't like politics in general. You know, I know that sounds odd coming from somebody that's running for office. But I don't like the politics. I don't like the team sport. I don't like the aspect where right after the election, people are thinking about what are we going to do in 2 or 4 years. I'm thinking about what can we do in the next they're thinking about next 2 or 4 years to regain control or keep our seat or do whatever. And I'm thinking, what can we do in the next 2 or 4 years to make a better life for Vermonters? That's what I think. We should become – we have a responsibility to transition to being public servants. And that's where I think a lot of people miss the boat. They maintain – we're all politicians during campaign time. But then you're supposed to transition. And I think many do it successfully, but there are many that fail miserably. And they continue to be politicians. And that's what creates the animosity. That's what creates the polarization. And what we should do is find consensus, bring people together, and let's get something done.
Who's your political idol?
Well, I have many, but, you know, Senator Mazza has been mine here in the state. He's been a tremendous supporter of mine over the years. Took me under his wing when I was in the Senate. We're of different parties. You know, that's unheard of that somebody would actually get along these days. You know, I think it was more common maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago. But these days, with that polarization I was talking about, you're not supposed to get along with your opponents or the other side, so to speak, the other team. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for him. He has a lot of integrity, and you know, we have a responsibility. Again, he's a public servant, and that's what I want to be.
What's the major differences between you and your opponent?
You know, I can just talk about myself. I'm a blue collar guy. I grew up in this area. I grew up in Barrie, I'm proud of my blue collar roots. I think that gives me a sense of appreciation for how hard people work, and how difficult it can be. And I stay in contact with them, whether it's in the racetrack or whether it's in as a politician or whether it's in you know, working out in the field. That they feel as though they can talk to me, and that I will listen to them, and I understand what they're going through, and I think that I have that sense of attachment to them, because I am one, and I've had my share of ups and downs over the years, just like they have, and I'm not complaining. I've got a good life, and I have a lot to be proud of, and I'm fortunate to be where I am. But I've had some times when I've struggled too, and so I get it, and I have a sense of compassion for what they go through, and that's why I do some of the things that I do, and that's why I try and take the politics out of it, and try and talk about what is it we can do together to make things better.
Let me ask this question: in the first 100 days of a Scott administration, what would it look like?
Well, there'd be some changes, that's for sure. More of a focus on the economy, obviously. The opioid issue is something that I think affects the economy. And I want to give credit where credit's due. Governor Shumlin brought this up in his State of the State, and it was the appropriate thing to do. And we need to build on that, because it really does affect each and every one of us. And if you don't think it does, you're just not aware of it. Because it does. All our families and our, you know, our friends, our neighbors, we're affected, and it's affecting our economy. So that's something that need to focus on. I'm going to put talented, quality people as in my administration. And the party affiliation is not going to be a litmus test. It's going to be about quality. What can we do? Share my vision in terms of strengthening the economy, making Vermont more affordable, and helping Vermonters. And if you can agree to that, then and you've got the talent and the background and the ability to adhere to a budget and think outside the box in terms of what we can do in that particular agency or department to help in regards to the economy, then you may be my person.
We're speaking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, who is the Republican candidate for governor. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. When we come back, we'll go into some specific issues that Vermonters are dealing with. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with us in our WDEV studios is Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, Republican candidate for governor. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Before we turn to the phone calls, let's turn to the issue of guns. Your opponent wishes to have universal background checks and restriction of assault-style rifles. What's your opinion, or why is that wrong?
Here's where we differ. I don't believe that we need any changes to our gun laws in Vermont. We're the safest, one of the safest states in the nation, and I'm just not advocating for any changes whatsoever. I understand the desire of some to cut down on the amount of violence. But I don't think taking their guns away or doing anything to restrict them in any way is going to accomplish that. I believe that we need to focus on what are the drivers of the violence itself. Because as we've seen across the world, there are many who are using whatever methods they can find to do harm. And sometimes it involves a gun. Sometimes it involves a car or a truck or a bomb or an airplane. I mean, it's just, they're going to find means to do harm to others one way or another, with or without guns. So I think we missed the point, and I think we should be focusing on the mental health issues, the opioid issue, the drug substance abuse problems that lead to the violence.
We're speaking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, Republican candidate for governor. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line. Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Rich, you're on Open Mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Mr. Scott, Sue Minter is attempting to define what it is to be pro-choice, and that means to her being an absolutist with no restrictions up to the time of birth, no parental notification for minors, which, by the way, is completely inconsistent with all of our other policies regarding minors making medical decisions without a guardian being at least notified. Sue Minter also claims to be pro-Second Amendment, but she advocates for some serious restrictions on this constitutional right to bear arms. Sometimes I find it very useful to compare the issues of abortion and gun rights, because they're both life and death issues. They both have constitutional protections. Maybe you need to expose her hypocrisy in this issue. I mean, her being an absolutist and defining the issue on reproductive choice, and also making the claim, as she has many times, that she is pro-Second Amendment, yet she advocate some pretty serious restrictions on a woman on the rights to own a gun.
Thanks, Rich, for the phone call. Let's start with guns. Your opponent has proposed, putting restrictions on in terms of restrictions on assault style rifles and also universal background checks. Is that anti-Second Amendment?
Yeah, well, it is. In terms of assault weapons, I would ask that people define what an assault weapon really is. I'm a sportsman. I have my share of. I've been deer hunting most of my life, but I would say that some of the deer rifles I might own could be classified as an assault weapon. I mean, if it's the look is changing. If it's a stock, the type of stock that looks military, you could have that on a deer rifle. It doesn't make it an assault weapon. Deer rifles are semi-automatics in some cases. And so I would ask that they define what that means, because I don't think it gets them to where they want to go. So I again, we'll reiterate, I'm not advocating for any changes in our gun laws here in Vermont. We're one of the safest states in the nation, and I think we should be focusing on the other fundamental issues.
Let's go back to the abortion issue. Again, you're pro-choice. The ads against you are running that you are not pro-choice. How do you address that?
Well, again, I'm not advocating. I'm not running this as an issue. In a Phil Scott administration, nobody's rights are going to be violated. They're not at risk. I'm not advocating for this. It's not on my agenda. I want to focus on the economy and making Vermont more affordable. That's my agenda. And then restore the faith and trust that we've lost in government. I think that we have a responsibility to do that as well.
Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor and Republican candidate for Governor Phil Scott.
I just want to, first of all, thank you for having the courage to take on this task. It appears that good people tend to get bashed by the party that's trying to stay in power here. I see it with what's going on the national level with the director of the FBI. I see a big hammer coming down here. I'm looking at all the people that are coming into our state, and I hope you can address this, Lieutenant Governor, that the attack on the two-party system here, I think, is what's at jeopardy here. I think you're seeing a party that wants to be a monolithic party. We've got the president weighing in on your job. We got Al Franken coming from Saturday Night Live weighing in on your job. We got everybody and their brother. Apparently, we must have a lot of power in this state that I didn't realize that we had, that they need to take you out. And I just find what they've done to you to be apprehensible.
Well, thanks. Thank you, Sam, for reminding me about all those those folks lining up against me. I did, over the last couple of weeks, it's a bit daunting, to be honest with you. I mean, you have the Vice President of the United States, the President of the United States, a very popular senator that was running for president, all lining up against you. As I travel around the state as well, and you get a great bump when I'm talking to the working class, the blue collar folks, the ones that are really struggling to make ends meet, and you have their support. I may not have the support of the political elitists. And it's not that I don't want them, but I'm much more concerned about the folks, the regular people of Vermont, and what their needs are. And if they support me, I'm good with that. They are a priority to me. But it is when you bring up the negativity and some of those the daunting tasks of running for office, I think that's part of what's wrong. When you think about how some this quest for power, that the all important, it's almost like the Lord of the Rings, where you got to get to the ring, that's so powerful, and you have to attain this office, and they will stop at nothing to get there. Sometimes campaigns and politics brings out the worst in people, and so it prevents a lot of people from stepping up, because we have a lot of great people in Vermont that should be in office. They should be running for the legislature. They should be for the legislature. They should be running for state offices, and they don't, because of the antics, some of the things that they're seeing today, because they don't want to put themselves out there. They have great ideas, and they'd be great leaders, and they'd be great for Vermont. But they don't want to subject their families and themselves to this type of attack. And it's so unfortunate.
Let's go to Mary and Randolph. Mary, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, Republican candidate for governor.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Lieutenant Governor.
Good morning.
Wonderful to speak with you. You have my vote. One of the best things that you've said this morning is that you are a public servant. And I think everyone out there really needs to hear that. That's why we vote, because we're choosing people to lead us and to, carry out our wishes. So I think I'm wholeheartedly behind that, being a public servant, and I appreciate your service.
Well, thanks. It isn't about my ego. It's not something that I've aspired to do my entire life. It's something that I feel a tremendous responsibility to move forward with and step up and lead and do something to help ourselves out. And I think I'm the right person, the right time to do that. I look at our volunteer firefighters, and I look at our first responders throughout Vermont, and I think about what they do. You know, they when they come onto the scene of an accident or they see a problem that exists, they run towards it, not away from it. And they don't ask when they get there. Their first questions aren't who caused it and what you know they don't ask the questions about what's your socioeconomic background. They don't ask you know what your gender is and what your sexual preference is. They ask what they can do to help, you know, and that's the page I'm going to take out of their playbook. That what is it we can do to help Vermonters rather than divide Vermonters? Let's unite and do something good for all of us.
Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott and Republican candidate for Governor Phil Scott.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
A couple questions and a comment, and I'll try to be quick. Currently, what is the total budget for the state of Vermont, roughly?
About $5.5 billion.
Okay. And total amount of employees? Roughly?
Hovers around, you mean state employees?
Yeah.
I'd say around under 10,000, somewhere around 10,000. I think it depends on whether you take part-time and full-time, but I think it's around 10,000.
Okay. Here's my comment. I've read plenty of books. I'm college educated. I've seen enough studies done to know this. Regardless of whether you're private or public sector, profit or nonprofit, LLC, corporation, it doesn't matter. When you get to be a certain size, there's an inherent amount of waste, fraud, theft, misuse in monies, to the tune of somewhere between 7 and 20% in any business. What I don't understand is why it's so difficult to tell all the social service and any of the programs down there, we're not going to expect you to not pay out the money. You're going to give the same amount of money, the same amount of good to this state that you've been giving, but you're going to do it with 5, 10, 15, 20% less because you're going to go and you're going to clean up your act. And no one's accusing them of doing anything illegal. All we're saying is that money is being wasted. Find out where it's being wasted and stop it.
Thanks, Paul, for your phone call. Money being wasted?
Well, you know, I think you can have efficiencies in government. I think that if anyone doesn't believe that there's not money to be saved somewhere by modernization and efficiencies, they're just not aware either. Because the reality is, I don't care if it's my own business or whether it's the state government, there's always ways to save. Or even in our own households, there's always ways to save. There's a way to do things, prioritize, and make sure we're getting the most out of our hard-earned dollars. And that's why I have this modernization plan. And I would ask people to go to my website. It's another plan that I put forward in trying to find efficiencies, modernize government. When we look at things like Medicaid, for instance, a third of our population is somehow enrolled in Medicaid. A third of our budget goes towards Medicaid. And when we look at the administrative costs of that program, it's increased by $100 million over the last 7 years. You know that's about a 15% admin cost, and that's too high. And I believe that we can do it more efficiently. So I think there are areas of government that we should take a look at. We had a PICUS report, this report done on education in Vermont. It was done by the Legislative Council, nonpartisan, just a balanced approach. What can we do to save money in education? They came up with $150 million worth of savings, but nobody acted on it. So there, in the Shout report, you know, in the healthcare, there was $150 million there that they said we could save in some way. We should take a look at those reports that we asked for, and let's provide some action.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Let's go to John in Burlington. John, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Congratulations on a great first half hour Republican infomercial. Lollipop questions you asked were right down fitting the Republican agenda the whole way.
John, ask a question or get off the line.
Phil two things. No mention about the $4 million that his company took in while he was an elected official from the state government. And secondly, Phil, you say you're a deer hunter. Do you need a gun that fires 100 rounds a minute? And do you need a gun that will pierce the armor, the vest of a police officer?
Thanks, John, for your phone call. First of all, there isn't a gun out there unless you have a 100 magazine clip.
Yeah.
That would do
well, my point was I could take my my deer rifle, and I could put a magazine in there that held, you know, a clip of 20 or 25. I mean, I could make my deer rifle into an assault weapon if it's the magazine you're talking about. My point was only that it's hard to define what an assault weapon really is, and maybe John is describing that it's the magazine. I don't know, you know, but it's not the weapon itself. It's not the look of the weapon. So that they need to clearly define what they're talking about. In terms of my business, you know, I took some heat during the primary for this. I decided, and it started in the general election, that my business was a problem for some, and I said, I'll take it off the table. You know, I'll sell my share of the business. And it didn't come easily. I've been in business now for 30 years, and I'm proud of my business. I'm proud of my employees, and they work very, very hard, and proud of all the work that we've done and the integrity of our company. So when they started taking shots at my employees and my family and our business, I thought it's time to separate myself from that. So I've taken a pledge that if I'm elected, I'll sell my share of the business. Now, the amount of money that that John is talking about, that's over a 16-year period. That's gross. That's not net. That's gross. I've always held the integrity of our company in high regard, and my reputation means a lot to me. And so I take great exception when anybody calls that into question. So I took that off the table, John.
Mm-hmm. And I take great exception when people say that I'm being biased. So let's go to Don in Montpelier. Don, you're on open mic.
Good morning, gentlemen. During the past session, there's been a lot of discussion about a carbon tax. Phil, you don't support this carbon tax, do you?
Well, no. No, I've made it pretty clear that I think a carbon tax would just increase the cost of living throughout, ratchet up the cost of living in Vermont. And I've said that if it came to my desk, which I hopefully they're not going to take that up this session, but if it came to my desk, I would veto it. I think it just is not right. We're not on an island here. We can't afford it. I'm not looking to do anything to increase the costs on everyday working Vermonters.
Let's go to Jerry in Callis. Jerry, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, Republican candidate for governor.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Boy, you really, when you mentioned that we have 10,000 or approximately 10,000 people as state employees today, that is awful. Too high.
Thanks, Jerry. Too high.
Well, you know, we need to be as efficient as possible, and what I've been advocating for is, I think what we need to do is, even for the state employees that are worried about their jobs and so forth, what we need to do is grow the economy. We'll need those 10,000 state employees. They provide an important function for us, plowing our roads, the work in the Agency of Natural Resources, all the agencies that really help us in providing the services that Vermonters need. But we need to focus on trying to grow the population a bit. We have this stagnant population with this demographic shift. We're losing our youth. There's less people working today than there was 7 years ago. These are all issues that are real, and this crisis of affordability is real, and it's real for state employees as well. So what we need to do, again, is all get together and address the problem.
Let's go to Cindy in Barrie. Cindy, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott.
Good morning, guys. It's great to listen to you this morning and answer all the questions. Phil, I am a big supporter of yours. I spend time in the State House. I pay attention to issues. And the biggest thing I have to say to the people that are listening today is I'm a Democrat. I am a lifelong Democrat, and I am voting for Phil Scott. That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you, Cindy. I really do appreciate that. And you're not, you know, to be honest, you're not the first person that's told me that today. I was just down at the coffee shop this morning, and two or three people came in and said the same thing, that they're Democrats, but they're supporting me. And as a Republican, I've always served the minority. I know that I would never get elected by just having Republican support. So over these, this is my ninth election representing Washington County for 10 years. I had a lot of support from Democrats as well. So I thank them for thinking beyond the label, thinking beyond the letter beside my name, and looking objectively about what I stand for and what I would do. I try and do what I can for all of Vermont.
Let's go to Fred in East Montpelier. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Lieutenant Governor, medical costs are estimated at being 40% in the last 2 weeks of life. Would you support a law that would mandatory make people have a medical directive so that families can decide what they want for their end-of-life care? And two, if poor people voted, all the work that you've done with Wheels for Warmth and the thousands of families that you've helped, you would walk away with this election. But poor people don't vote.
Thanks, Fred.
Well, thank you very much. In terms of the directive, I think it's a good idea for each and every one of us to think about. We're all going to, unfortunately, pass away at some point. And I think that we should properly plan for what we want to happen at the end of life. But I think that's an individual decision, something you make with your family and you take upon yourself. I don't want the government to get involved in that.
Let's go to Eric and Johnson. Eric, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Lieutenant Governor.
Good morning.
I wanted to bring to your attention when the carbon tax question comes up, and I think you have a debate today that Sue Minter will bring to your attention how bad last year's winter was. And then she'll highlight the ski industry and the snowmobile industry and how important global warming is, which I agree with her. It's our most important issue, but I think she's a bit misinformed to say the ski industry, when it's one of Vermont's contributors to carbon and high electricity rates. And it's just ironic that she's highlighting one of the worst carbon emitters for the reason she wants a carbon tax. And you got my vote. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. And I just to reiterate, I just think that the carbon tax is a bad idea for Vermont just because of the cost of living increase that it would cause. Because you think about it, with whether it's your products, your food, or your services, or even your school systems, if everyone had to pay, you know, for an increased cost of fuel or carbon, whether it's to heat the building or to provide for bus services for your school kids to get to school, everyone's going to have to pay more. So that's just going to drive up the cost of living of your food products and services and so forth. So I'm not looking to do anything to increase the cost of living on hardworking Vermonters. I'm looking to decrease that or at least cap it so it doesn't get any worse.
Let's go to a caller in Fairfax. You're on with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Good morning.
Hi, I think actually this is Bill from Middlebury.
Okay, Bill.
So I was just curious, with all the Planned Parenthood attack ads from the DNC, I was curious, why haven't you put some ads on out there basically outlining what your actual position is to counter, you know, the people that are actually believing these ads? And that's basically my question for you. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough issue. I'm trying to be proactive. I'm trying to talk about the economy. I'm trying to talk about the affordability. I'm trying to talk about jobs. I don't want to get sucked into explaining my view on an issue that shouldn't be a top priority at this point in time. I think the economy is it, and it's very expensive to advertise. Very expensive. I'm being outspent in this campaign, and the Minter campaign's doing a great job in raising money out of state, by the way, from many. 90% of our dollars are raised right here in the state of Vermont, And I don't think that the other camp can claim anywhere near that. A lot of their dollars come from California and so forth. So, I'm frugal by nature, trying to live within our means, doing whatever we can with the money we have. But I want to focus on what I can bring to the table rather than trying to explain to everyone what my position is on being pro-choice, because I've been pro-choice my entire political life.
Let's go to Conrad in Calais. Conrad, you're on open mic with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott.
Hi, gentlemen. Hi, Phil.
Good morning.
I've known you a long time, Phil, and I know that you will do a good job for us. I have one thing that concerns me is property taxes. I haven't heard much mention about it, but I know that you will do what you can to stop this increase on property taxes somehow. And again, you have my vote, and I tell everybody I see you better vote for Phil.
Well, thank you very much, Conrad. That's a huge issue for us. And here, let's get to the root of the problem. We are educating 86,000 kids, 20,000 less than 20 years ago, and it's costing us $1.6 billion. So that's almost a third, between a quarter and a third of our entire budget for education. What we need to do is we need to address the spending issues in this state. I think that when we have to think outside the box in delivering a 21st century education in a much different way. If I went out, and I'm sure the listenership, you have a bright listenership here, Mike. If I went out to any of them, or I went to the colleges and universities, I said, look, I've got $1.6 billion here I'll give you, and I need to educate 86,000 kids. I dare say we'd be doing it different than we're doing it today. And we have to have the courage and the will to look outside the box in providing that so we can have a quality education. I'm an advocate for pre-K. And that's, some would say, well, doesn't that increase the cost? But I'm saying live within our means. Let's take advantage of the PICUS reports where we can save $150 million. And maybe what we can do with that PICUS report is maybe we can put a third of it towards pre-K and child care. And then maybe we can take half of it and give it back to taxpayers. We can have the best of two worlds if we're willing to take advantage of some of the reports and recommendations that we ask for.
Let's go to a caller from Reigate. You're on with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So Phil runs a construction company, so he knows what seasonal help is. We used to be, if we had a callback date in the spring, we didn't have to look for work during the winter. Our employers pay in most of the unemployment anyway. I've been with the same company 32 years, and yet after 10 weeks, I have to go bother people like Phil's partner, Donnie, and everybody else around here that hires help just so I can keep drawing the unemployment that my employer already paid in. Now, would Phil do anything about that?
Well, you're not the first one to complain about that. I do believe that there are some opportunities for a lot of people, particularly in like the ski area. I read or saw on TV where they're having a big job fair. And I tried to put a program together a few years ago with construction workers. And when they get laid off, because it's not easy to go full time, especially in the earth excavation business, because the ground freezes up and you can't do the work. But maybe they could have a job on the slopes, maybe grooming and so forth. And so I tried to put something together. It didn't work out quite the way I'd hoped, but I think there's opportunity in the future. But I understand the problem when you're not able to find a job that meets your needs, to just go through the steps of just making applications isn't being very efficient either.
Bob, I'm going to take your phone call, but I only got about 20 seconds for a question.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
One thing of great concern to me is the sacrifice of Vermont ridgelines to big winds so some out-of-staters can make a lot of money. How would you address that?
Yeah, I'm very concerned myself. I like renewables. I'm an advocate for renewables. I think there's other options rather than destroying our ridgelines. So I will do everything I can to stop ridgeline development, something that I think is tearing the social fabric of Vermont apart and putting Vermonter against Vermonter in many different communities. So I think we should take the other approach, go to solar, go to other means, biomass and other hydro, and let's forget about ridgeline development of wind.
You know, I only got to about a quarter of my questions. I thank all the callers. That was very gracious of you. Those that support Phil, those that don't support Phil, I thank you for your phone calls. I also thank you for your courtesy in calling in. Phil, thank you very much for coming in.
Well, it's great to debate some of the issues. And again, we don't always have to agree, but let's do so civilly. And I think we did that on the program.
Phil Scott, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, candidate for governor. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then Jessica Lowe, Burlington Free Press reporter. And we're going to be talking about a story that she did on background checks for pre-K workers, or lack of. We'll open up some of the phone lines in the second half hour with a question. The question is this presidential race the low mark in your lifetime, such as lows in campaigning, American journalism, and the candidates themselves? This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. You're listening to WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island and Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. You can click on that website and then click on the Open Mic podcast to listen to Open Mic anytime at your convenience. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're going to turn our attention to national issues in a moment. I just wanted to let you know that we just heard from Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. I did invite Sue Minter on. Their campaign never got back to me, so it looks like we will not have Sue Minter on until perhaps some other time. So we'll talk about that at some other time. I try to get both candidates on in order to give them a last shot to talk to you, the audience. But right now, let's turn our attention to national issues, and on the line is Justin Duckham. Justin, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here. How are you?
Great. Hey, the FBI, they seem to be in the midst of several sort of controversies. The latest one is another document release where they have released the documents on the pardon of Mark Rich. This has raised eyebrows. Why?
It certainly has. This was revealed on a Twitter account that had been dormant for about a year until this was released. This was a Twitter account used by the FBI typically to release public documents that had come out during FOIA investigations, and it has only fueled a lot of criticism of the FBI coming from the Clinton camp. They have been running sort of an offensive against the FBI, saying that it really appears that Comey is holding them to a double standard by not moving forward with additional information on Donald Trump. By releasing that vague letter to members of Congress, which was a departure from historical precedent, with some of them even accusing him of breaking the law, as was in the case with Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, wherein he said that Comey may have violated the Hatch Act, which is a law that prohibits career federal employees from engaging in electioneering. So that's been getting a lot of attention. That account also released some documents related to Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, dating back a couple of decades, but that's not anything that has, sort of soothed things with the Clinton camp. And then on the right, Comey is also coming under some additional criticism after it was revealed, around today, that the FBI did not seize devices from Clinton's top staffers, leading to questions over how thorough the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private server was, and fueling some additional calls for further investigation to take place from Congress.
Justin, what I was interested in, and it was a change of strategy or change of tactics over the weekend. On Friday, I thought a good tactic of Hillary Clinton was say, released these emails right now. Let's let the public see what they are. And then the strategy changed over the weekend where they just went after the FBI director. Does that strategy boomerang? After all, the FBI wouldn't be involved in this if it wasn't for the fact that these emails are on a private server.
I mean, yeah, I think it could, come with considerable risk. Obviously, if you have a good portion of Trump supporters accusing you of being corrupt and, violating the law, going after the top lawman probably does not necessarily help your chances. But it's a gamble that a lot of Democrats seem willing to take. This has gone just beyond the Clinton campaign, who has not specifically accused Comey of wrongdoing. They've kept open the possibility that he is a good man, perhaps was just misguided or just had a lapse of judgment in this case. They've accused him of releasing a letter that was, in the words of John Podesta, long on innuendo, short on facts. So not a flat-out sort of criticism or attack on him, but one that's certainly a veiled kind of snipe to a small extent. But I think it certainly does come with considerable risk, and that's something that at least one prominent Democrat, Ed Rendell, who has always sort of been sort of a Clinton ally, somebody who gained some additional prominence within the party this year when he was sort of the driving force behind bringing the convention to Philadelphia, weighed in. He described this as a mistake. We haven't seen many people following in his footsteps, but I would not be surprised to see, as you mentioned, this be sort of a boomerang or face or result in some kind of blowback for the team.
One of the things that sort of inoculates the FBI director is the fact that President Obama and Vice President Biden have come out in support of him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is sort of a division that's going on between the Clinton campaign and the Obama administration. The fact that they have sort of stood by the FBI director, they haven't really called his judgment into question, which particularly makes sense considering that he was an Obama appointee, somebody that they have defended a good number of times in the past, and just not really eager to kind of cause any waves in that front in the waning days of the Obama administration. But I spoke with a Clinton spokesperson yesterday, Guy Smith, who is an advisor and official spokesperson, and he himself was pretty noncommittal when it came to these prospects of Comey completing his 10-year term. They wouldn't say one way or another if Clinton was going to keep him on in the new administration to serve until about 2023, when he's scheduled to eventually depart. I thought that was pretty telling, to say the least, in terms of what may be going on there. Typically, you would see the campaign playing it cautious to just kind of stand by him and say, regardless of what happens, they're going to move forward with him. But the fact that they're not yet ready to say that is pretty interesting, to say the least, in my mind.
One of the things that I also find fascinating as I sort of scan the news is the circumstances that are happening at CNN. Donna Brazile was sort of released from CNN because she gave a question to the Clinton campaign, a question that was going to be asked in a debate between Secretary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Does this sort of feed into the notion that the system is rigged?
It does, and that's why this has been something that's been viewed as troubling. The president of CNN, Jeff Zucker, said yesterday that the announcement of that, or the revelation rather, was, in his words, disgusting for that very reason. The fact that there is already a lot of doubt around the media, this sort of idea that the press meets in back rooms to figure out how to exactly rig the race, and that sort of reflected poorly on the network in that sense. But Donna Brazile is not a journalist. She's not on CNN breaking news. She's there as a political analyst, one who is billed specifically as a Democratic strategist. But either way, the fact that she may have had early access to information and then passed it on does not bode well for her. even though there is, some speculation that perhaps this was, not exactly as it was portrayed. You know, she has previously said that some of the releases from WikiLeaks that bore her name were just not real. She denied the veracity of them. I would imagine that she would probably take a similar position today. But either way, this is a big deal considering that she has been elevated to interim DNC chair moving forward, and that has certainly caused some distress within the Democratic world.
One of the things that is happening now, so here we are. We got national polls that are very tight. In some national polls, Donald Trump is leading by 1 point. In others, Hillary Clinton is up by 2 points. But as we all know, the action is in the battleground states. How are we doing for electoral votes? Is it still in Clinton's favor?
It still is in Clinton's favor, despite the fact that we have seen on the national level that Trump is having a significant uptick. The big news yesterday was an ABC News Washington Post tracking poll that showed that Trump had a 1 point lead on Clinton. Down today, that is at about, there's another similar poll coming from ABC Washington News that showed that the race was dead tied. Considering the margin of error, which is about 2.5 points, that means that on the national level, it could still really swing either way and that there shouldn't be too much red necessarily into that. Hillary Clinton still has an advantage when it comes to the Electoral College. Trump would have to win a pretty significant number of swing states and take one, state that went for Obama in 2012 and then flip it in order to win in this situation. And that is, still relatively unlikely considering that Clinton has a pretty impressive ground operation so far. Also worth noting, back in 2012, Obama overperformed a lot of poll estimates by about 3%, and that was against Mitt Romney, who actually had a team on the ground in a good number of states, actually put forward a much larger effort than Donald Trump, and was frankly a much more viable candidate in the long run.
Justin, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You have a good one.
Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Coming up, Jessica Allo, who is with the Burlington Free Press. She wrote a fascinating article about background checks and pre-K employees and the lack of background checks. We'll talk with her in just a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my great pleasure to have on the line with us this morning Jessica Allo, who is a Burlington Free Press reporter. And the reason we have her on the line is she wrote a very interesting story about background checks for pre-K workers. And I wanted to talk to Jessica today about that story. Good morning, Jess.
Morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for being here. Your story surprised me because I had expected that all background checks for pre-K employees would have been done. What did you find?
Well, so there's two different kinds of background checks we're talking about here. Every worker is background checked. They're checked against Vermont databases. But to get a fingerprint-supported background check, which allows them to check the FBI databases and across the country, is something that they're implementing. All public students have to do it. All public schools have to do it. So teachers have been doing this for a while. But now that we've rolled out universal pre-K, the state sort of thinks of school beginning at age 3 now instead of beginning in kindergarten. So now pre-K workers and people who are in private preschools but are getting federal funding through Act 166 also have to be fingerprinted. And this is part also, in addition to this, all child care workers will have to be fingerprinted within the next 2 years to meet federal regulations. That's not pre-K, that's just daycare. But this is it's been a very rough process for the state. The state has had a lot of backlog. The workers have to go through their local sheriff's office, their police departments, get fingerprinted. That has to be sent to the Vermont Crime Information Center and then sent back to the providers to say, okay, that's clear, and that can take weeks. And there are some providers who are still waiting to get their appointments. And in the meantime, the state doesn't really know. It's on the licensee, it's on the providers to make sure that they're complying with the rules, and it's on school districts to decide whether they should withhold payments until this is done or whether they should find another way around that.
So one of the, as I was reading the article, it seems like there's two issues that we can talk about. One is sort of the backlog in the fingerprinting and background check. But also, what surprised me is the system doesn't indicate whether a person has submitted or required to submit.
Right.
And that is another problem, isn't it?
Right, that is. I had originally asked the Department of Children and Families, who is running this program, for a list of all the providers and what percentage had been fingerprinted and cleared. We had had reports about the backlog, and that really surprised me when they said they have no way of knowing who they've missed, so they can't give me the percentage. That definitely took me by surprise, because what they told me was that they have staffing lists, but not everyone on those staffing lists is required to be fingerprinted at this time. So they don't know, they just don't have an idea of who they're missing.
Which is, it seems like that's a flaw in the system.
Right.
And when you interview a provider, they seem to think it's confusing as well, don't they?
Right. They've told me they've gotten, and we've seen a sample of this, they have gotten a lot of different information from the state. They have gotten information saying, okay, do this now, do this. The schools are going to be able to pay you, but they're not. Sign this letter that assures schools that you are taking care of it, and nobody who hasn't been fingerprinted is alone with kids, which is can be a really big burden on a provider who some of these are really small programs. They don't have that many employees, and to have someone, because they're so backlogged and because they haven't been able to get an appointment yet, to have to be, can't be alone with a student and can't be alone with a child, means that you have to double people up. So that can be really burdensome. And then for a lot of these providers, they it's really on them and their word to ensure that this is all going the way that it's supposed to be.
So the way that I look at this article, there are three sort of major issues. One is the background checks for the fingerprints that has a backlog. The second is that the system can't tell who's supposed to be submitting and who isn't submitting. And lastly is sort of the confusion that's around there,
right,
and the paper load dump on the providers. Am I missing anything out there?
I think that pretty much covers it. One of the providers I talked to told me that at this point, all the providers, when they go to these meetings, they just sort of laugh about it because it's become so confusing. And they see the importance of doing these fingerprint checks. They're not saying that's a joke, but the whole process has just become so confusing for them.
So who is responsible here? Is it DCF? Is it the Agency of Education? Is it the school district? Is it all of the above or none of the above?
Well, it's hard for me to say exactly who is responsible. I think that DCF is the one leading the process for this right now, but the Agency of Education is also the one, and the school districts are the one, actually, that the money goes from the state to the school districts to the pre-K. So in a way, they are, while they don't really have that much to do with the process of fingerprinting, they're not the ones doing the checks, they're the ones who may be liable if something happens.
And that's the school district you're talking about.
Yes.
And so if the school, what?
And I'm sure they're not entirely pleased about that situation.
And that's what I was going to say. I'm a little confused as I'm reading what the role of the Agency of Education is in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, the agency, they do not make this simple. The Agency of Education oversees the school districts, and the school districts are the ones who are, essentially, these private pre-Ks are under contract with school districts to provide public pre-K, provide the universal pre-K. This is all part of that rollout. And that's where the Agency of Education comes in, as in their role overseeing the school districts.
When you read the article, and thank you for doing this, because I was not aware of any of this, the process seems to be unorganized, it seems to be chaotic, confusing. There are people working in this system to try to find a way to make it better?
Well, I think that the Agency of Education has been trying to provide some guidance to their school districts, as much as they can. I know that they've sent out, and I think the DCF is also trying to provide some guidance. I mean, one thing that really struck me, too, is that this is the reason why the DCF is sort of taking over this roles because it's as part of the new child care licensing programs. And many of these pre-Ks, these private pre-Ks, are part of daycare programs. They all have to be fingerprint checked. But right now, they're prioritizing the pre-K. But eventually, this is going to have to happen for all daycare as well. And that's why DCF is sort of the one leading the process. But that also struck me as interesting in the sense that they basically have tried to make this simplified by prioritizing pre-K.
Mm-hmm. And any indication from providers, from DCF, from the Agency of Education, from school districts for that matter, when this is expected to get better?
Well, the DCF has said that they've processed over 1,000 people. They're hopeful that soon everyone will be able to get through this backlog, and eventually by 2 years from now, they'll all have been fingerprinted, and so they can just say, okay, if you're not fingerprinted, you can't be in one of these centers. So that's sort of the answer they've given me on that. But other than for this year, what the assistant commissioner for that oversees the child development division, Eva Murphy, told me was, well, we keep getting new waves of applications every day.
So let me just...
And by applications, I mean fingerprint,
right.
The fingerprints.
And if you're not fingerprinted and you can't perform your duties, doesn't that cause a problem for the provider in trying to provide
right.
these
so
services?
Either they have to be supervised at all times, which does provide a big burden on providers, or some school districts have said they're not going to pay the voucher, the $3,000 or so for each kid, until everyone in that center who has to be fingerprinted has been. And so that means that these pre-Ks might not be paid, and these are small businesses. So it's been, I think, a real stress for a lot of providers.
Seems like a catch-22. We're not going to pay you until you get it fingerprinted, but we can't get it fingerprinted because
right.
we got a backlog.
Right.
What do parents have to do to ensure that background checks are done and that they feel
well,
that their children
what
are safe?
What the state has said is call your provider, talk to them about it. They'll have the information.
Huh.
And, a lot of parents aren't aware of this. And unless the provider has taken on themselves to tell parents, they probably would not have any idea. Most of the parents who I spoke to while doing the story had no idea that they were even doing fingerprint-supported background checks, let alone that there was a problem with them.
Hey, Jess, this is a great story. You did a great job on this. And
well, thank you.
I really appreciate bringing this to light because it is a major problem here in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Jess, thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's Jessica Allo, who's the Burlington Free Press reporter, and we've been talking about background checks for pre-K providers or the lack of. There's sort of three problems that Jess brought out in her article, which I just, if you get a chance, go to the Free Press website and read this article. It's really enlightening in terms of what's happening out there. There's a backlog on doing these background checks, and these are the sort of the fingerprint background checks that the law requires be done in these pre-K centers. But also the system itself. I mean, there seems to be a lot of confusion of who's going to be submitting. How do you track those that are submitting? Who is required to submit? The system seems to be lacking, I guess, is the word. And then third, just the confusion of all the emails, all the sort of letters that are coming down from different bureaucracies to the providers. And if you read Jessica's article, the providers want to comply here. It's in their best interest to comply. They want to comply. It just seems to be very, very confusing. When we come back, let's open up the phone lines. Let's talk about this presidential race. Is it the low mark in your lifetime for campaigns? What about American journalism? Is it a low mark for them as well? As well as the candidates. Is this the low mark for the various candidates that we have had? This is Open Mic. Hey, welcome back to Open Mic. We're going to open up the phone lines, and guess what? We're going to ask this question. Is this presidential race the low mark in your lifetime for
campaigns, for American journalism, and for candidates. As I scanned the national newspapers today, that seemed to be the prevalent theme out there. Nobody is happy with anything. And I was just wondering what your feelings are about this presidential race. Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. One of the things that I sort of picked off the internet was Michael Goodwin, who is a conservative columnist with the New York Post. But it was interesting, some of the things that he put out in terms of journalism, talking about the low mark, the low water mark of American journalism. And he said, when we're speaking today, and he was referring to Eisenhower, when Eisenhower made that famous quote that the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex, he basically is saying that today could be considered the media political complex and the unwarranted influence of that complex. And what he says is that there's a cozy confederacy with the incumbent sort of political factions that are largely not with the public will. And we've talked about this before on this program, that people are upset with political elite, with those that are in power, both politically and in business leadership. And that has only grown since the recession of 2008. And although polls, what Michael Goodwin points out, that although polls show a tightening race, that Donald Trump gets far more negative coverage than Hillary Clinton. And then he talks about the coziness of various reporters. For example, John Podesta, who is the Clinton campaign chairman, because of a WikiLeaks, was caught basically with the ability to edit a reporter's writing, which is unheard of. And then he talks about what we did, talked about here with Justin Duckham from Talk Media News, about this cozy relationship that the Clinton administration had with Donna Brazile, who was a paid commentator for CNN, and her feeding questions to the Clinton campaign questions that would be asked in a town hall meeting debate with Bernie Sanders. And also the fact that nobody in the Clinton campaign thought this was ill-advised, and talking about that. And he makes the decision that, look, reporters now have become commentators, and commentators have become more commentators in terms of trying to sway one side or the other. And he thinks this is the low point of American journalism. And if you go to George Will, who is not a Trump supporter, and I don't believe he's a Clinton supporter either, but he says, as the presidential campaigns sink to the challenge of demonstrating that there is no such thing as a rock bottom in this presidential campaign. So what do you think? Is the presidential race the low mark in your lifetime in terms of the campaign itself, American journalism, or the candidates? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bill in Barrie. Bill, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. The answer is yes. This is not only is it the low mark, it is, I am afraid. I've never been like this before. And I'll say right off the bat, if it was today, if I was in the polling booth right now, I'd skip the presidential. I wouldn't vote for either one. This is how I feel. I said it the other day. I'm afraid of both of them. And I'm going to leave it at that and say there is a high mark in the election. And I am going to the polls. And because you had a class act on the last hour, Phil Scott. He knows already, so I didn't have to call and talk to him because he knows I'm going to vote for him anyway. But I'll say this. I don't agree with every one of his issues, but he brings up the important issues, the ones that are going to get me or not. And I'm afraid, what am I going to do about medical payments and stuff like this? We have a lot of expenses, and they're making it hard. And if it gets any worse, we're going to be devastated. So definitely, I don't care much for the presidential thing, and I just think I'm going to skip the president. I just can't vote for somebody who I know is going to hurt me. Either one.
Thanks, Bill, for your phone call. Bill says it is the low point of his lifetime in terms of campaigns. But what about expanding that a little bit? Not only the low point of campaigns, but is it the low point for American journalism as well as candidates? I mean, the process itself produced two flawed candidates. And I know we have a responsibility to vote. But don't the candidates have a responsibility too? And isn't that to convince voters to vote for them? And in this election, as you know, most Americans feel that they would vote for neither if they had the shot. And political parties, mustn't they find a way to nominate qualified and more appealing candidates? Don't they have a responsibility to do that as well? The press has taken a heavy hit in this election in terms of its objectivity. Is it the candidates themselves that is causing this, or is it a change in journalism? For example, are these institutions, whether they're newspapers or cable network news or mainstream sort of CBS, ABC, Fox, NBC, are they chasing an audience? And is that polarizing us? Meaning, are they looking to go for an audience that they can possibly attract, whether it's left or whether it's right? Interesting sort of dilemma that we find ourselves in journalism today. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, if Thomas Paine was here today, he would say, where's the common sense? These are the times that try men's minds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he would. He would. What? And what would he do?
He'd write a pamphlet.
You're absolutely right, Fred. And it certainly is interesting. What do you think? Is this the low mark of your lifetime?
No, it's exciting, I think, because it does try our minds. Really, doesn't it?
It does in a way, but I'm not sure it tries our minds in a good way. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it does, because you've got two candidates, and we have to listen to both of them very carefully, and then we have to make up our own minds. So we got to really think about this.
Interesting perspective, Fred. Thank you so much for calling. The presidential race, is it the low mark in our lifetimes? The campaigns, journalism, and candidates? You know, who has the responsibility? Also, I got a couple of things in the stack today that I want to get to. One is Garrison Nelson wrote a fascinating piece in Vermont Digger. Garrison Nelson is a retired political science professor at the University of Vermont, and he sort of compared some historical things going on in the governor's race, which I will share with you in a minute. But I also want to take an opportunity to talk about the WCAX poll, because the WCAX poll had three items that were clearly above every other item out there. I mean, far and above every other item out there in terms of when you ask voters what's the most important issue to you. The economy and jobs was number one. That is no surprise. Healthcare was number two. And I believe that most people equate healthcare nowadays with cost, because access to healthcare in terms of affordability is a cost item. And also probably there's some residual impact of the mess that we had at Vermont Health Connect. So healthcare was number two. Number three was taxes. If you combine all those three, we're basically talking about the cost of living and jobs in the economy in Vermont. What do you think? Is that your number one issue? Is that the issue that moves you, or are there other issues? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. One of the other things that is out there that I thought is interesting is that we have this dilemma with the FBI. They're being demonized. And is it right or is it wrong to demonize the FBI? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Three questions out there for you to sort of ponder and give me a call on your opinion, your comments, your impressions. One, is this the lowest you've seen in terms of, have we hit the low water mark in terms of presidential elections, in terms of journalism, in terms of the process, as we talk about the process? Number two, WCAX has released a poll, and the top issues are mostly money-driven. The economy, jobs, cost of living in Vermont. Do you agree with the WCAX poll? And then, you know, the whole thing about the FBI. Do you think we are demonizing the FBI or not? Or maybe they should be demonized. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'll take your phone calls when we come back. Welcome back to Open Mic. We'll get to the phone lines in just a moment. I just want to take a moment to talk about Jet Service Envelopes in Barrie. The reason I want to talk about them, you know the reason. They're a great local family business, and no matter how small or how large your project is, their focus is on servicing your needs. If you want a printer who combines quality, personalized, friendly service, and job dependability, guess where you need to go? That's Jet Service Envelopes. You know, their employees take great pride in the work they do for you, and that pride is reflected in the quality products they produce for you. If you need printing services, whether envelopes, posters, cards, or this time of year, Christmas cards, it's never too early to get Christmas cards, by the way, newsletters, brochures, or a magazine or book, Jet Service Envelopes and their sister organizations, Accurate Printing or Spalding Press in Bethel, can meet your needs. Just visit them off Exit 6 on I-89 in Barrie and Spalding Press on Main Street in Bethel during the working hours, 7 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., or email them at info@jetservice-envelope.com. I bet you'll find a long-term partner to meet your printing needs. We've been talking about, is this presidential election sort of the low point? Is it the low watermark for journalism? Is it the low watermark for the sort of the campaigns? Is it the low watermark for the type of candidates we've got? Also, WCAX polls showed that the economy and economic issues were number one. Is that the number one issue for you? And lastly, the FBI has been getting criticized. Are they being demonized for no reason or for valid reasons? Let's go to Larry in Hardwick. Larry, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Getting back to your first question, is this the lowest point? Well, no, I have to say it's not, because I'm 62 years old. I've seen a lot of elections. Richard Nixon is the first person I voted for, and you see how that worked out. The most disgusting thing about it is the amount of money that is being spent on these elections. You see the Phil Scott Sumenter ads, the presidential ads, the ads from New Hampshire, and just the amount of money. It's getting to where you just need hip boots to walk around here to keep from ruining your shoes.
Larry, thank you for your call. Great comment. Thank you for your call. Let's go to another Larry in Barrie. Larry?
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you, sir.
I understand that Leahy is going to finally debate his opponent. Do you know when that's going to be and where?
I think it's today, actually, Larry. I think it's at noontime, and I'm trying. It may be, I don't know, try VPR. I know there's a debate today, and I think it's VPR, Larry.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Dana in Barrie. Dana, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, I think that Scott Lewis, a while back, we should appoint a special prosecutor. And I don't know what they're doing now. I think those candidates actually should be vetted by the FBI before they run. Not biased, not trying to be biased to one party or another. But I'm sure they're going to vote for a pathological liar in Hillary Clinton.
Thanks, Dana, for your phone call. Dana, the you know, that's actually, I'm going to pick up on one of those points there. I'm not sure that I would have the FBI vetting who we want to run for president. But at the same time, should have this been sort of handed over to a special prosecutor? The Justice Department makes that determination. They haven't made that determination. And as you know, in July, Comey said there was no reason for prosecution on this particular issue. He has now opened up the investigation because they seem to have been surprised by emails that were on Anthony Weiner's former or estranged husband of one of Hillary Clinton's closest aides. And one of the things that I think the FBI is in a rock and a hard place on this one, and be interested in your opinion. Let's go to Jonathan. We're talking low points of presidential elections, a WCAX poll on the economy, and the FBI. Jonathan, good morning.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
I am fine, thank you, sir.
It's very low. The low point in our electoral process, let's see if I can articulate this. Voting for Hillary means that we're okay with two families in our country having 24 years of rule between the Bushes and Clintons, respectively. We had two terms of Bush and a one-term Bush, and we had two terms of Clinton, and electing a Clinton means we'll get, you know, 12 years of Clinton rule and 12 years of Bush rule.
So it's sort of an aristocracy, sort of.
Yeah, oligarchy, for sure, and close to, like, a monarchy system, which makes it feel like there's not a democracy here.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the low point for the electoral. The low point for journalism is that when voters go into the booth, there was going to be more than two choices for president on that ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And the two other major parties that I know will be on the ballot get zero media coverage as a viable choice for people to be informed to make decisions for themselves that would help them cast a vote for a candidate that truly represents their points of view. So the limiting coverage of the other two parties that will be on the presidential ballot is by the media it's a travesty of the press.
You know, Jonathan, you raised some good points. Thank you very much. I mean, that is. We have Jill Stein on the ballot. We have Gary Johnson on the ballot. We have other people on the ballot. We have other people on the Vermont ballot as well when you go in to vote for president. And a lot of people don't know a lot about these candidates. I do want to switch just briefly. I'm trying to get through my pile, Tom. I know I'm not going to get through all of it, but I'll try to get through this aspect. I've got about 5 minutes left. Garrison Nelson, who's a retired professor of political science at the University of Vermont, written numerous a seven-volume book about Congress, and has commentated throughout the years on Vermont politics. He wrote a fascinating op-ed piece in Vermont Digger, and one of the things was the curse of the lieutenant governorship. In 1958, Bob Stafford was the last lieutenant governor to be elected and ascend to the governorship. Now, you will say, well, what about Howard Dean? Well, Howard Dean ascended not through election, but through the death of Richard Snelling. And it is interesting, even with open seats, and even when they go against an incumbent, the curse of the lieutenant governor, 1958, is the last time that a lieutenant governor has, in fact, won an election for governor. The interesting thing also, and if Phil Scott breaks this, he'll be like the Cubs, I mean, or the Indians. I mean, they're losing streaks. So Phil Scott will be one of the persons that could break this if he wins. The other is sort of the party alternations, where that in the 1800s you had, well, you know, 1800s you had the sort of the western side of the Green Mountains would alternate between the eastern side. It was called the Mountain Rule, where it was basically one party, 108 years and 50 Republican governors, but they would alternate between one side of the mountain range and the other side of the mountain range. It was an interesting thing. But that, you know, was broken. But what hasn't been broken is that the fact that when you have an open seat, it usually falls to the other party that's different from who has the governorship now. And on presidential coattails, I'll just say briefly, there hasn't been that much of a presidential coattail here in Vermont. They usually split the tickets because you can split the tickets, and that is something that is really interesting, at least to me, as we move forward in thinking about this upcoming election. Got about 2 minutes ago. I want to thank our guest today, and our guest today was Phil Scott, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, a candidate for governor, and also Jess Allo, who is a Burlington Free Press reporter. And I would urge you to read two things today. One is the article about the background checks for pre-K employees, and also go to Vermont Digger and read Garrison Nelson. I think you'll find that a very enjoyable read about some Vermont history as we move forward into the gubernatorial election 6 days from today, in our election process 6 days from this. If you want to listen to Open Mic at any time, at your convenience, we understand you're busy and sometimes you can't listen to it from 9 to 11. Would hope you would, but if you can't, go to our website at wdevradio.com and click on the Open Mic icon there on the wdevradio.com website. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. Yep. We have a glorious past, but we're celebrating the future. You're listening to WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 98.3 FM from Montpelier. And we're serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com, and you can go to that website, click on the Open Mic podcast, and listen to this program anytime. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls today, a lot of them, and I thank you for them. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.